Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for August 19th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well, how are you?
Very well, very well. And we're also joined by our other frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Great. So climate change is thought or expected, is predicted to produce more intense rainfalls. And that's because as the air warms up, it's able to hold more humidity. That's a classic hot, hazy summer day, right? More water in the air turns into more intense rainstorms. And we've had several examples of quite intense rainfall over the last couple of days. One over in Italy. DR, tell me about the one in Italy briefly. What happened there?
Yes, at least 39 dead after a bridge collapsed in Genoa, Italy, under intense rain, and just, you know, highlighting how much of our infrastructure is not ready to deal with intense rain or heavy temperature or high temperatures or the consequences of carbon pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that people are simply, you know, not really being aware about how much of our infrastructure is vulnerable. I mean, mm-hmm. You think about, in Massachusetts, I remember for years how people used to make fun and mock Michael Dukakis, the former governor of Massachusetts, when he talked about the poor shape of our roads and our bridges. And that was and that was just, you know, because of, you know, poor maintenance. Mm-hmm. When you add in extreme weather to mm-hmm. poor maintenance, you have a tragedy, yeah, right. Multiple tragedies waiting to happen.
Yeah, I think this bridge in Italy, which is quite dramatic, I mean, you can't say in the first instance that the heavy rains caused it, but this sort of, because there's maintenance questions about the bridge, yada, yada. But certainly the intense rainfall as a player there was important. I guess the other interesting fact that you pointed out was that over this past weekend, there were quite intense rains right here in Old Beantown. We don't even need to go over to Italy, right? We had flooding on downtown Boston streets.
Yes, and as well as flooding, I believe in I think Peabody and Lynn, there was intense flooding, and again, you know, look at how the roads being impassable. The thing that struck me, and I'll never forget it, is that the day after the flooding in Lynn, mm-hmm. there was a cover of the Boston Herald that I think the headline was "Trapped," showing the intense flooding, and when you think about the irony of that. And for all the years where various columnists and editorial page writers at the Boston Herald made fun of Al Gore, mocked the need to address this issue, and now you're seeing literally front page news, mm-hmm. the consequences of what Gore and others were talking about.
Right. I think that the connection here is that there's a couple instances where the transportation infrastructure and transport were interacting with climate change. And for me, it brings up the whole question of how the whole transportation system in the state of Massachusetts, and of course, as a microcosm for the country and the world, right? But that's why we talk about, but we know Massachusetts. I mean, we have transportation issues here that are related to carbon emissions and global warming carbon mitigation. It turns out that here in Massachusetts, we have, under the Global Warming Solutions Act, we have a commitment to reduce carbon emissions by different amounts by the year 2020 and the year 2030. But about a third of the carbon emissions that come from the state of Massachusetts come from transportation. That is to say, from automobiles and trucks and trains and stuff, right? And that is a serious kind of challenge because the emissions from automobiles are diffuse. Hundreds of thousands of cars running around the streets of Massachusetts. How do you manage to reduce the emissions from all of those things, right? I suspect one of the ways to do that is to get electric vehicles going, right? I mean, I think if you had electric vehicles, that would be a good thing. But tell me, Mariah, you saw something, you mentioned something before. It's kind of far out there, but it's a great idea. It's an appealing thing to begin a discussion. I mean, what did you see that got you going?
Well, so, you know, one of the issues that people always state with electric cars, and, you know, myself included, right, we're definitely going to get an electric car for our households, but they get 50 miles, right, before they need to be charged, and then they have to be plugged in for 30 minutes. And so you really have to, you know, you have to suit it to how often do you drive, how much do you drive, and when do you have a chance to charge it. And of course, there's, you know, the Tesla car, of course, gets, some of them get up to 300 miles on a charge, and they can supercharge. So there's a range in there. But generally, when you talk to people about electric cars, they're like, sure, it's great, but what happens when they run out of, you know, when they run out of juice. And I think there's a really funny clip a meme that I've seen where somebody has an electric car as a getaway car from a, you know, a robbery, and the electric car, they're speeding down the road, and then the electric car runs out of juice, and that's the end of their getaway car, you know.
They're caper. Right?
So, exactly. But interestingly, there's this in Sweden. So this is not here. This is across the ocean. But in Sweden, they have it's the first electrified road. So it actually charges the cars as they drive over it. And I'm pretty sure it's a 2 kilometer electrified road in Arlanda, Sweden. And it's I mean, that, you know, you think about the miles and miles of talking about updating infrastructure, the miles and miles we have of roads that are just purely there to drive upon. And what if we could use them? What if they were solar, you know, the roads were actually solar panels and they also charged your electric car? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, that sort of changes the game for making electric vehicles feasible for everyone as a means of transportation. And of course, I also hear the common argument to that as well. Yeah, even if you have an electric car, it's still powered by the grid, which is powered by fossil fuels. But the whole point is that if you electrify everything, A, it's more efficient. That energy uptake is more efficient when it's from electricity. And B, you can slowly start transitioning the grid away from fossil fuels and onto renewable energy. And
right. It eliminates that kind of diffuse source problem, right? We now have 1 million combustion engines, right? Not again, 300,000 combustion engines on Route 128, right? It's hard to manage those, but if they were all charging off of one power plant, then you could manage that power plant and make sure it was clean, right? So I mean, that's fascinating because you could have, you know, if I-95 from Boston to Florida had a continuous stretch of charging roadway, you could drive your electric vehicle all the way without even stopping, right? And have it be powered by solar panels for free, basically. I mean, it's a great dream of the future. It is something that you can be excited about and say, yeah, this is the kind of thing that you could get to if you were to commit to the technology, right? Commit to building this stuff.
And think of the jobs it would create.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to rebuild.
So much for climate change, you know, addressing climate change, crippling the economy. I mean, come on.
Well, and I think that it's kind of exciting because I think we spoke last week, but if we'll mention it now, is that the Vineyard Wind project, right, that's proposed to be built in 2019, is coming in at an estimated energy cost. I mean, specifically, it's called the levelized cost of electricity over 20 years or something. Bottom line is the way they compare the cost of electricity, these wind turbines are really competitive with all the other forms of generation, and they're dramatically less than anyone expected. So all of a sudden, this wind turbine can put out power really cheaply. And if that trend continues, you get into a world where I dare not say, well, I'll say it, I'll be like Donald Trump, I'll tease it, and I'll say, I don't want to say it, I will say it. I mean, too cheap to meter will never happen, right? But you can have so much cheap electricity floating around from if these technologies get good enough that you could basically run all kinds of stuff that you right now would be limited because you can't get enough power, because the electric power is would become relatively cheap, which is sort of this reverse image from the past where people say renewable energy is too expensive. Well, it could turn into be incredibly cheap, which enables all kinds of other stuff. You're looking a little askance, Mariah. Tell me, are you buying it? Or are you saying no? Ted's off the deep end on this one.
No, I mean, I'm just thinking, how does that model then work for utility? I mean, that's, of course, that's the answer to why the utilities are so anti-renewables, right? I mean, there you have it in the bag. If there's that potential, in so many ways, if it just not being, it's not a winning strategy for them to be providing electricity anymore. So who will provide it? And you know, and even you think about the road. I'm just kind of thinking about the setup of this e-road. Who pays for the charge that their cars are getting? You know, how does that sort of cost structure work?
I mean, I heard a podcast with I think it was the Energy Gang. Did you ever listen to that? And the guy who set up Sun Edison out on the West Coast. Anyway, long and short of it, the point he was making is that every technical innovation, so the e-road is a technical innovation, has to be accompanied by a business innovation. That somehow you can't take advantage of the technology until you invent a business model by which you can sell it. So to your point, Mariah, right, you've got this road, right, you can do this really cool thing, right, how are you going to end up paying for it, right? I mean, I guess I would say everyone's going to have a transponder in the car, and as you drive down that magic highway, the meat is going to keep turning as you drive along, and you're going to get charged for using that, right? But it is true that, like, solar panels on the roof are a great thing, but until people came along with kind of these net metering programs and the ability to lease the panel on your roof, all these business models, that's what makes the technology take off. So same thing with the magic roadway here, huh?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I can just see my George Jetson vehicle zooming down I-95. So tell me this. If you talk about transponders monitoring your procession down the magic e-highway, right? Calculating how much you should pay per mile as you drive along. That suggests a whole other question about limiting carbon emissions in Massachusetts, which is much more feasible, which is called demand pricing. That is to say, take those easy pass gantries that you see on the Mass Pike, and put them all around the city of Boston and charge people for driving into downtown Boston or anywhere, right? Up and down 128, up and down 95, just make people pay for the privilege of going on the road. Do you think that's a fair thing, or will that cause a revolution to have people with their pitchforks in the streets? No takers on that one, huh? You guys don't know. So I was in Singapore years ago, and as I was in the taxi cab, and there's a sign over the street that says, you're going to pay $3 if you go underneath this thing to drive into downtown of the city, right? Just to limit the congestion, right? I think that if you do that, the rich people, they don't care, $3 or $4 to go to the city. It's the poor sucker who's got to drive to work every day, who's making minimum wage, that has to pay to go underneath into downtown. He's the one who gets hit. Is that fair?
Well, interestingly, though, so in Oakland, I forget what the name of the bridge is. It's probably
it's not the Bay Bridge.
I think it is. Maybe, I'm not sure. But anyways, one of the bridges has a very high toll. And what has resulted from that is this thing called a casual carpool, where a bunch of people, so if you have a carpool, if you have more than whatever, two people, or I guess it must be even more than one person in your car, I think you get reduced or eliminated tolls, or maybe the people share the tolls or whatever it is. People will wait underneath the bridge. The car will pull up. You get into the car and you all carpool over the bridge. And so it has created this, like, sort of underground, interesting, organic carpooling system to help avoid the toll. So, you know, there's no question that I think it would push sort of more sustainable methods of transport. But, you know, as you said, would there be a revolt? And I also wonder, is that the right place to push back? Certainly transportation is, as you mentioned, one third of the greenhouse gas emissions in Massachusetts come from transportation. So that's definitely one of Massachusetts' biggest weak points on the climate. And I think countrywide, it's also something we need a lot of work on. And So, you know, is that the right target? Is it to target people, or is it to target businesses, or is it to target the, you know, government fleet to get them to all drive electric vehicles?
So let me answer your question. Here's what I think we should be doing is encouraging growth of cities in an organic way that reduces the demand to drive halfway across the state to get a job. Right, so you have mass transit, you have housing near mass transit, the smart growth initiative, right? You build your cities in a way that reduces congestion because you don't need as much, you don't need as many roads or cars, right? High density housing, stuff like that. And of course, it's, you want it to be nice, right? But this is the urban planning or city planning is critical to how much transportation there is. So in the long run, if you really want to cut down on vehicle usage, you have to rethink the layout of the highway system, where people live, where people work, and how they get around. And that's the long-term solution, which is much more challenging. Trust me, that was a scary one.
Mm.
But so the other one, I got to throw out there because we're going to have to quit in a minute. But the I heard this story on the radio. You guys correct me if I'm wrong, but there is this electric scooter company called Bird. I think it's called Bird. And the idea is that there's these scooters, I believe, are unlocked by a code that you get over your cell phone. So you can just walk up to one on the street, and if you get the code to take that little electric scooter, you get to take it and drive away, and you're good to go until you're done with it. And then somebody else picks it up and moves on to the next place. Turns out this company called Bird, simply distributed these scooters all around the city of Cambridge without telling anybody, without asking for permission. And all of a sudden, the city manager wakes up early one morning and finds out he's got electric scooters all over his city.
That's unbelievable. He
goes bananas and sues the people and collects them all. But I guess, I mean, the real question is, do you think that these kind of social transportation companies, like the bike sharing kiosks and the bike shares now that, again, have a lock on them that you can unlock with your cell phone. So now you've dispensed with the need for the little places where you park the bikes. You have Uber, you have Lyft. I mean, all these socially enabled transportation methods, do you think that that's a solution to climate change? Do you think that cuts down pollution in total? Again, that's a hard question, but I mean, it seems to me that it could help, right? More bikes can't hurt.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was in Denmark, the number of bikes on the road is staggering. I mean, everybody is on a bike. When you pull up to an intersection, there are like 50 bikes on the road, and there's like three cars. I'm not even kidding. I mean, it is extreme, and it's amazing. And I think, you know, of course, there's sort of the dual thing where you also have, it also helps with people are biking. There's help, you know, that's healthy. It's an active lifestyle. And
not
there's
so
all
much
kinds of
smelly
dual
ozone.
Benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that part of it's great. I was in San Diego where they have this scooter system, and the problem with these scooters, I mean, so you literally, when you are done with it, like you get to your friend's house or you get to the grocery store or whatever, you just leave it. You just walk away. So the scooters are everywhere. I mean, they are all over the town. And, you know, at the end of the day, they go around with the truck and they pick them all up and they put them back in one central location. But they're everywhere. And people are out in the middle of the road on the scooters with no bike helmet. They're just zipping along. I mean, like, you know, it's like anybody who's got a link to it can use it. So there's really no regulation around like safety or, you know,
I mean, there's no etiquette or protocol yet for how to use this stuff, really.
And clearly there's no etiquette about how to implement in a city, because apparently you can just dump them on the roads and let people
walk away.
To it.
Yeah. Well, I guess as you know, what your mother said about picking up, looking after this stuff on, you know, cleaning things up probably still holds. But yeah, I think that's a risk. I mean, people just walk away from the bike and it's in some crazy spot. That's probably not good for the city, right?
Yeah, I mean, they can track them all, right? They have them all sort of, so they know exactly where everyone is, every single bike is, so they can retain them. But It's not a. You're correct in that it's not a car, so it's not polluting as much as a car.
Well,
it's electric.
When I get to maybe next time I go to Cambridge, I'll jump on an electric scooter. You can if you see me flying, I'll go by saying ciao as I zoom up the street on my scooter. Anyway, we got to leave it there. We got to transport ourselves out of this show. Thanks everyone for listening. What we'll do is put up some links, although we were all over the lot with this conversation, links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find a link to the show on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using all those famous things like Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, we're on Apple Podcasts. So please rank us. We'll close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty never to leave our bike where someone can trip over it, and that we must speak out. We must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thanks for being around.
Thank you.
And all you guys out there on your bikes and scooters, be careful, okay? We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.